Welcome to the show, everybody. It's Cairo Nights with Mace and Mike on this Tuesday evening. I hope you're doing okay. Frank Shires, he's here with us.
Present.
He'll do the news at the top and the bottom of the hour. And DB, David Burbank, on the ones and twos for only a few more days. Yeah.
Cry.
Yeah.
Stop it.
In case you missed it, you made the announcement, what was it, Friday night at the end of the show?
Correct.
Yeah. So in case not everybody at 7 makes it to 10, you know, so I just want to get it out there that DB is moving on to greener pastures at the end of this week, and we will miss you, buddy. We'll have to...
Thank you. Now everyone at the station also knows because there was a staff-wide email
that's
sent
right.
out. So that's great. Dory reached out to me. It was very actually
nice. Oh, that's sweet.
And, yeah, everyone. Thank you.
Yeah. I spent an amount of time that I'm uncomfortable admitting looking for just the perfect GIF to send you in response. I finally settled on Sam and Frodo hugging at the end of The Return of the King as Frodo sails off. So I'll just tell you that instead of actually sending you the GIF.
You send him a map of New Zealand.
You've seen it. He's been there. He knows more about
it. I have one framed very beautifully by my father.
I bet you knew. I bet you do. How are you feeling today, Mike Lewis?
I'm feeling good.
Yeah. We got a great, we have an amazing guest in the 8 o'clock hour. His name is Tim Egan. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning writer for the New York Times. He was part of a story called How Race is Lived in America. I won a Pulitzer for that. And then he's also the author of The Worst Hard Time, which is a book about the Dust Bowl during the Great Depression, the crisis within the crisis. As Mike likes to put it, and just a fascinating guy, knows a lot, and we're going to talk to him about what happened back then, how things today are actually very similar. You know, history is an amazing thing. It tends to repeat itself, and so there are so many things that we can learn from the past that apply to the present. He's also going to tell us about how we should move forward. You know, there's a lot of hope coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, too. But we have some news to get to, so we're going to get to it.
Here's the top three things we need to discuss. Number one.
All right, number one is national. We're going to take a look at the big picture here. What's happening all around the United States. Protests continue for the 8th day in downtown Minneapolis. That's where thousands of people are gathering outside of Cup Foods on 38th and Chicago Avenue to honor the life and memory of George Floyd. The Washington Post was in Minneapolis yesterday during peaceful protests talking to passionate demonstrators.
Every single day that I've been out, it's been peaceful. We protest peacefully. We're here to serve justice for injustice. That's why we're here. And this is the story that we need to show because this is the real Minnesota. Justice means community. Justice means loving each other no matter what background you have.
Yep.
It doesn't matter what race you are, what creed, anything. What we saw was inhumane, and we have to show humanity in this community.
One Minneapolis resident, Dionysus America, claimed that a fire had been lit and it's propelling America forward.
It lit a fire under the butts of America. And I hate to say it, but everybody has a purpose in life. And I think that his death was to light a fire under this country. And at the end of the day, nations were built on blood. This is a fact. And something needs to change in this country right now. And people are motivated. It's sad that it takes somebody dying to motivate a country. But at the end of the day, that's the reality that we have to deal with.
In the nation's capital, hundreds of protesters gathered at the base of the Lincoln Memorial, where they remained peaceful until dispersing after the city's curfew set in at 7 p.m. A D.C. resident stayed out past curfew in order to vote, by the way, in the city's primary election. There are elections happening all around the country today. Thousands gathered in Chicago and Los Angeles this afternoon, continuing peaceful protests up until curfew hours. One demonstrator in Los Angeles delivered this message.
We want peace. You look at all these wonderful people out here. Look at us. And this is not just black people. These are all people out here. And we're trying to tell the police all over the country, if you just march with us, you're showing that you're not standing in solidarity for a system that has oppressed people for hundreds of years. We just want you to show that you are with us, because this is the America that I want my kids to live in and be proud of, that finally stands up to the meaning of its creed.
From Houston to Orlando to Philadelphia and Phoenix, demonstrators continue to come out in droves, standing up against police brutality. And meanwhile, President Trump continues to receive negative feedback on his comments. surrounding the death of George Floyd and police reform. Presidential candidate Joe Biden spoke to the public today, and here's what he had to say.
The country is crying out for leadership. Leadership that can recognize pain and deep grief of communities that have had a knee on their neck for a long time.
Biden calling on leaders to confront systemic racism and blasting Trump for that Bible photo op.
I just wish he opened it once in a while instead of brandishing it. If he opened it, he could have learned something.
Tonight, Biden is calling on Congress to ban chokeholds and vowing to establish a national police oversight commission.
Donald Trump has turned this country into a battlefield riven by old resentments and fresh fears. He thinks division helps him. His narcissism has become more important than the nation's well-being that he leads.
And Biden's promise less than 6 months from the election.
I promise you this. I won't traffic in fear and division. I won't fan the flames of hate. I'll seek to heal the racial wounds that have long plagued our country, not use them for political gain.
That was ABC News' Mary Bruce, by the way. Curfews are continuing in large cities around the U.S. as many areas enter their fifth, sixth, seventh, or eighth days of protest.
Yeah, the same is starting to happen here, but Houston earlier looked like it was getting fairly tense. It seems like it has cooled considerably now. I'm certainly hoping that we can find a way to get through these situations and not, you know, that park clearing yesterday was pretty upsetting.
Yeah,
it was mainly because it was unnecessary.
Yes,
why ramp people up like that just for a photo opportunity? It didn't really make a whole lot of sense except to show this sort of, you know, show of strength, which really just shows weakness. It was surprising to me, and I think that those are the type of photo ops that go a long way toward bringing the protesters out the next day, and the day after that, because they are what they see is no evidence that things are changing much at all.
Number two.
Demonstrators in Seattle are out again this evening for the fifth night after nearly 6 hours of peaceful protests in the Capitol Hill area of the city yesterday before police became aggressive. Here is Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott from last night.
What started as a peaceful protest in honor of George Floyd and to speak out against police brutality and racial injustice at Westlake Park around 3 this afternoon, went all around the city for hours, totally peaceful, went bad up on Capitol Hill after about an hour and a half of protesters and Seattle police and state patrol troopers having a bit of a standoff at a barricade. Someone said something, or perhaps I'm hearing that there might have been a protester who threw something. And then an armored vehicle, tear gas, beanbags all came out, and hundreds of the protesters fled down the hill. Many of them hit with pepper spray or tear gas in their eyes. The group split off. Some went to the youth jail, saying that some people had been arrested. Others headed back towards Westlake, where the National Guard was standing there waiting for them to try to circle back, really driving them where they want them to go as they head back up towards Capitol Hill.
Today, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin and Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best spoke to protesters, giving their support for the cause. This is from Chief Best.
I really stand with you. I understand the hurt and the anger that everyone feels, especially after the death of George Floyd. You know, as a black woman, you know, I feel the same pain you feel. And just because I wear the uniform, that doesn't change that. And there's a whole lot of people who support you.
Mayor Durkin spoke during a press conference following the protests and talked about the need for change.
Too many in America and in Seattle are tired of words and promises. We must make real and durable change. In committing to those changes, we must admit and acknowledge the deep, deep systematic racial barriers are real and affect, as I said, every system in our society.
The mayor claimed that the police department will be looking at how to best mitigate protests.
SPD will be looking at seeing what operational changes they need to make in crowd management to determine a better way to go forward and to keep officers safe, community safe, and protesters safe.
The changes that the mayor is proposing are long term.
It's not just important for us to ensure that there's accountability in the short term. We must also ensure that it works towards in weeks and months to come. and processes we put in place have to include community input. I was able to meet with some of the protesters today who want their voice at the table talking about the changes they think need to be made. The chief and I will continue to meet with them, to listen to them, and to include others in the community so many are at the table.
Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best also announced today that the city will extend its nightly curfew from 9 p.m. to 5 p.m. throughout the remainder of the week, which means that they are anticipating that the protests are not likely to end tonight or tomorrow night.
I was watching last night. I saw it unfold. I saw what happened. And it was really, really disturbing. Anytime we talk about law enforcement on this show, I always, always say, I can't understand what a difficult job that must be, right? About the stress that you're under, about it's a hard gig. It's something I could never do. But the truth is, you saw the video. It was on video. There were cameras there. There were cameras everywhere. There was video posted later in the evening that showed exactly what happened. There was a barricade. There were protesters on one side. There was law enforcement on the other. Someone took an umbrella from a an officer, or someone took an umbrella from a protester. And then it looked like there was something. It looked like a water bottle was thrown. And the pepper spray came out and the flashbangs and all that. Now, here's the thing. That is a disproportionate reaction to what's happening, okay? That if there's one person, let's say there's 99% of people out there, 99.5% of people out there doing the right thing and following the rules and remaining peaceful and expressing their First Amendment rights, well, there's going to be knuckleheads. There's going to be idiots. And it's the job, as people who are supposed to keep things safe, to protect people, to root them out and to make sure that those people are eliminated so that the constitutional rights of the other folks who are doing what they are supposed to be doing are protected. And to just bulldoze and injure and go after the 99% of people who were doing what they were supposed to be doing, I just don't think is a reasonable response to what's going on. You're in riot gear. A bottle of water is not a threat to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, and also just, I mean, your earlier point about proportional response is a fair one. I mean, that applies to average citizens. If someone has broken into your house and you're chasing them and they're running out on the lawn, you actually don't have the right to start to gun them down in the back,
right,
even though they did take your stuff and you are scared. I mean, all of that is completely justified, and hating the person and wanting to do something violent to them is understandable as a human emotion. But in this particular case, someone there, a supervisor there, should have said before it, look, if it's one thing gets thrown, sit tight and see if it. Now, if it starts to escalate, absolutely, then the police need to escalate at that point because their safety is paramount.
Right.
But if it's one person in the crowd, if one person in the crowd can essentially ruin it for all of law enforcement and all of the crowd, we need to think about what's a proportional response here. And in this particular case, I agree with you. It went from 0 to 100 immediately.
Yes.
And there was absolutely no reason to do that. And you want to know why that park is crowded again today and will be crowded again tomorrow? It's because of last night.
Right. Right.
Number three.
All right, let's go back to Washington, D.C., where reporting from the Washington Post has revealed how yesterday's protest went as President Trump came in front of demonstrators for the first time since George Floyd's death. According to the Post, Attorney General William Barr personally ordered law enforcement officials to clear the streets around Lafayette Square just before President Trump spoke Monday, a directive that prompted a show of aggression against a crowd of largely peaceful protesters, and that drew widespread condemnation. This comes as Trump is attempting to flex his authority, mobilizing the National Guard against primarily peaceful protesters, threatening to send the military into cities, things like that. Although the mayor of D.C., Muriel Bowser, refused the president's suggestion of implementing federal troops to quell crowds, National Guard-branded Humvees could be seen barreling through the streets of the city this evening. I mean, what can you say? This is inexcusable. You've got a bunch of people who, and listen, they may be justifiably scared, right? There may be people who see unrest who are scared. But as far as I understand, law enforcement and military training. I haven't been through it myself, but I have loved ones who have. You're trained not to react on your own fear. That's what training is for, because you don't know the situation, and fear exacerbates that kind of stuff and can just make things worse. So the idea that you would gas a crowd to get them to disperse so he could go do his dumb little photo op over by that church, which, by the way, the church is furious. Any religious person should be furious for doing what he did and using the Bible and a church as some sort of stunt. It's infuriating to me, and I don't know what else to say about it other than these people who are peacefully protesting, and you see a concerted effort. You hear maybe the news you consume, maybe you don't hear this. I don't know, but I see all over the place that the vast majority of protesters are doing things peacefully, and they are rooting out or trying to root out people who are causing a disruption. You're going to have people who are going to be violent, who are going to do the wrong thing, who are out there for reasons other than police reform and criminal justice. And you can't just slam your foot down and expect that to solve the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I would invite anyone who actually is curious about this, just call up. It doesn't matter whether you call up actually conservative or liberal media or whatever or what have you, or something more mainstream. You'll find the same videos, and the same videos will tell you one story, that these people were not a threat. They were simply gathered in a big number in the park, which is where protests happen all the time.
Right.
And if you're a smart administrator or leader, what you do is say, all right, they're there. I can get my photo op in any number of places. This wasn't simply about a photo op. This was about a show of strength. And if you listen to his language prior to all of this, he was forecasting that this would happen. And you may argue then, well, then they should have known. Well, what should they have known? What shouldn't they have known? What should they have known about their own rights for peaceful gathering and protest?
Right.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me that you would want to actually, if you are going to take and make your top officials parade in behind you on that walk of shame straight to the church, you have to ask yourself, like, well, why do you need to go there? And why they needed to go there is they wanted to walk right through and right in and on the proverbial and on the metaphorical throats of the people who decided to engage in peaceful protest, which even the president himself has said in his way. Now, I don't know whether this is just a cynical statement that he supports. Why would you need to direct it directly at them when you could have gone any other direction? I mean, it's an important thing to ask yourself, and it's really important, if you're not familiar with it, look at the video and see what story it tells you.
Rachel Bell coming up next. It's Kyra Knights. Stay tuned. Some air bass and hanging out with Rachel Bell.
A bass deserves its day in the sun. I feel like not enough people do air bass.
No.
I want to do air recorder.
That's not bad.
That's not. But I think, do you think people would know?
Let's start an air band.
Okay.
They think you were doing clarinet.
Oh, yeah, a lot of similarities.
But more like.
It doesn't work.
That's why you got to slap at a bass. Yeah.
You got to make bass face, though.
You got to make bass face.
Big time bass face.
Hashtag bass face.
Are you
going to
play in our air band, Mike?
I'll be the manager. I'll do air manager. I'll sit with my arms folded.
Air folded.
Perfect answer. Oh, gosh. What are we talking about today, Rachel?
What aren't we talking about? We are talking about walking. There's a podcast simply called Walking that is in its third season. And the person that hosts it, host being a very strong word as he doesn't speak in it, really, is very surprised that anybody actually wants to listen to it. So his name is John Mualim, and he lives on Bainbridge Island. And he's a writer for the New York Times Magazine and an author. He writes all kinds of things. And he started this podcast, I don't know if it's maybe not 3 years ago, but it's in its third season. And all the podcast is versions of this. It's just him walking.
Wow.
And there are seasons of this podcast. And according to the latest article about this, because there's been so many, it's gotten so much attention. The Seattle Times says that it's even more popular now during quarantine. And John says, quote, "It always seemed pointless to me, but it definitely started to seem really pointless once the quarantine started because now everyone was walking."
Right.
So he was surprised that anyone wanted to listen to him doing this thing that other people could be out doing.
I love that. I didn't want to turn it down.
Turn it back up.
Turn it back up. Yeah.
It is a nice ASMR.
Yeah.
We're kind of the equivalent of listening to rain when you go to sleep.
Yep.
But I'm curious, like, when people most commonly listen to this? While they're working or going to sleep?
While they're walking? Wouldn't that be a trip?
Ooh, that'd be so meta. Well, especially if you did walk in an urban area, then you could bring in the sounds of...
Yeah, nature walking.
Nature walking.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
How are you guys on ASMR stuff?
I don't get the official tingle that I think if you really respond to ASMR, but I can get a tiny slice of it with certain noises, but I don't get the full on like, whoa, but there's definitely certain voices that I really like. And this is kind of creepy, but very rarely I'll interview someone whose voice does that for me. And I'll listen to it over and over when I'm editing. And I'm like, this feels like I shouldn't be doing this right now.
Really?
But for people who don't know, ASMR is not a sexual thing. It comes off that way sometimes because it is certain sounds, like some people like whispering and some people like hearing someone like tap their fingernails on
or crinkle something.
And it if you react to it right, I don't know, that's not the right way to say it, but if you are somebody who is
reactive to it,
it's supposed to make your brain feel like it's melting, just like a very soothing feeling.
Yeah. I like it. It works for me.
It does.
Not all of it. And I don't get like, I get tingly sometimes, but I'm really sensitive to sounds.
This has nothing to do with any of this, but this just popped in my head. And I want to tell you guys this because last night my boyfriend gave me a fact that I was like, what a fact. Indeed. He said, do you want to know why pirates wear an eye patch? He had just heard this on a podcast. Apparently the reason that pirates wore eye patches was because they often had to go, you know, below into the boat to take care of stuff, and it was dark down there. So that way they had one eye that was already adjusted to the dark, so that when they would go downstairs, they would close the exposed eye and pull off the eye patch and would apparently be able to see better in the dark.
Really?
Yeah.
That's bizarre.
And so much sense being made here.
Well, but no depth perception.
Who needs that when you can see in the dark?
All right.
So fair. I want to know now if, like, the peg leg has a function, or the hook arm, or the parrot. Like, these all have completely practical functions, and they're not just things lost in a fight.
I am not going to pick a fight with your boyfriend. I would like to read that for myself.
Mike is suspect.
Me too.
Because I'm not entirely certain, because it just takes a few seconds to adjust, you know? And it's not like if you're sailing a boat, you're running up and back and forth below decks and up. It sounds to me odd. I'm not saying it's not true. I just want to
fact check.
Run that one
down.
Well,
you're a reporter, you know, for a long time by trade. And so it makes sense that I come in here with my dumb pirate fact. It sounds so fake. You're right. I'm Googling
but
it.
I would love for it to be true. It's kind of a funny idea.
Yeah.
I just Googled pirate eye patch truth. I think that I'll have to do this later. Oh, it does say that on childrensmuseum.org. Okay, we'll get to that later. Anyway.
I smell a story.
Yeah. With so many pirates running around these days, we really have to get to the bottom of this. Do we have time for another story?
We sure do.
Okay, so just quickly, were you guys pranksters in school?
No. I hate them.
I wasn't in school, but my dad was a prankster with the family, so
we got
pranked.
Really?
You had to stay on your toes around him.
My nightmare.
Yeah.
What was his best prank or his worst prank?
Well, they were kind of like impromptu. I think he would just every now and then decide, let's mess with the kids. And so one of my favorites was actually my older sister, Sally. She and my younger sister, Nancy, any siblings, they squabble a bit. And so she's always looking to do something to Nancy just to bug her. And one night she and her friend, Regina, came over. They'd gone out to a movie. We're probably at 11 o'clock at night on a Friday night, maybe. Nancy is, I think, a freshman in high school, maybe that old. And they're going like, Nancy, come on, it's time for school. And she like gets up really sleepy, goes in the bathroom, like does the shower, gets ready for school, comes out, starts eating breakfast, is like wondering like, well, where's mom today?
That's a good prank.
Oh, no, it kept going. And then she walks into the living room and sees my dad snoring on the couch. She's like, well, that's odd. Dad's rarely asleep on the couch at this particular time. And then everyone started laughing, and then she got angry. Door slamming, angry.
Do you know who Stephen Wright is?
Yes.
He's a comedian.
One of my favorite comedians.
With a very monotone delivery. Yeah. And he has a joke. He's, I was downstairs at midnight, and I was raiding the fridge and making a sandwich. And my mom came down, and she said, no, Steve, lunch is the other 12.
All of this to say... Mm-hmm. That the Wall Street Journal did an article that kids are doing pranks on Zoom.
Oh, boy.
Yeah,
Zoom
so
pranks.
Apparently, just like how people feel extra free to write mean comments on social media because they feel more free, kids who say they would never have been a prank puller in actual school are feeling more free to do them on Zoom, partially because if you do a really good one and you record it, the goal is to get a lot of likes on TikTok, of course.
So that's right, of course.
The reason why. And so they focus on a couple of kids who are doing pranks. One, for example, I mean, this one got 2.3 million views in 24 hours on TikTok. I watched it. I was incredibly bored by this prank. Like, this is not as good as what was done in your house.
Kids today don't know
though,
how to prank.
They don't. Like, listen to this. All this was the teacher was talking, and, you know, if you've been on a Zoom call with multiple people, it looks like a giant Brady Bunch. You know, you have everybody in their own square. And then the kid starts playing a song, and while the song's playing, he points to every one of his classmates in their different squares, and they turned off their cameras, and the word reconnecting appeared on each of their screens.
Oh, boy.
And the teacher thought that they had disconnected, but they hadn't. Like, that's 2.3 million views? Wake up Nancy at midnight, man.
Kid gets an F.
Yeah,
that's not great.
No. Yeah.
That's subpar pranking. And I'm anti-prank.
This is why the kid was never a pranker prior to this.
Exactly.
They just weren't good at it.
That's why.
And you have to blame the internet for watching.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Rachel Bell.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Rachel.
We'll be back, everybody. More Kara Nights after this. Everybody, Mason Mike, hanging out with you on this Tuesday. coming up at 8 o'clock. Just a rad guy. Can I say rad? Is that okay? Does that disqualify me as a professional? Tim Egan, he's a local guy. I think like a few generations of local.
I think third generation, yeah.
Third generation. He is a writer for the New York Times, won a Pulitzer for How Race is Lived in America. It's a fascinating, fascinating piece. And he also wrote a book called The Worst Hard Time, which Mike Lewis loves. And it's about the Great Depression, specifically the Dust Bowl. And so we're going to talk to him. We're going to have a little history lesson and look back and see how the events of the 30s apply to what's going on today and what lessons we can learn from history. History's great for that kind of thing. So that's going to be a really great talk with Tim Egan coming up at 8. But first, let's talk about the bridge. There's, you know, we're spinning a lot of tragic plates at the moment. And one of them happens to be that the West Seattle Bridge is shut down. 125,000 people use that every day. We don't know whether or not we're going to have to tear the whole thing down and build a new one, whether or not we can fix the one that's up right now. It's only been around for like 30-some years, I think, which is well below the life expectancy that was expected.
35, yeah.
And SDOT, they are soliciting engineers for a plan. They said today that companies who have made at least three government-owned bridges worth at least $200 million each, that they can submit their plans for a basically potential replacement should it come to that. The group that wins would take care of demolition and building. Heather Marks, she's the director of mobility for SDOT. She says in about 6 weeks they will have determined whether or not the bridge needs to can be fixed or needs to be replaced. And after that 6 weeks, then we get to figure out, well, replaced. What is the plan moving forward?
It's going to be replaced.
I think so, too.
Yeah, I don't see any reason, any way around it. I mean, this story also said that they plan on taking a decade to do it. That would be through the whole process, which is, it feels to me, I mean, I had a little back and forth with the Seattle Times reporter who knows more about transportation than anyone in the area, Mike Lindblom. And it wasn't like a terse exchange. It was just simply like, wow, you know, it took 9 years to get voters to approve and build the eastbound Tacoma Narrows Bridge. Much bigger, much more complicated, technically more complicated project. His rationale for why this one will take a long time is that one was more complicated technically, mm-hmm. less complicated politically. This one is more complicated politically, but it still feels to me like a decade from inception to people driving on it. And the decade is the estimate. And not often do transportation projects come in under the estimate.
Right.
So it could be, think about it. I mean, it could be 2032 before we have a bridge to West Seattle. I mean, a functional big bridge, not the low one, which is going to be limited strictly to bicycles and transit and probably trucks rolling in and out of Harbor Island.
Right.
And not much more than that. It seems like if it's going to take that long, if there's no real way around that, I do hope that there is some sort of parallel track to find ways to either offer companies incentive for relocating offices there, mm-hmm. or maybe work sites there, maybe some iteration, a better run iteration of WeWork, so people can work remotely in West Seattle and still retain their Seattle-centric jobs, or companies moving branch offices there, or any number of other things, from increased water taxis to some way to get people over here in an efficient manner. You know, I think that there is an opportunity here to maybe decide that maybe building the bridge, maybe the 10 years or the 12 years that it's going to take to build the bridge does not have to be time wasted only on building a bridge, but maybe on trying out different ideas for mass transit or different ideas for transportation. But I would say this, if you want a business idea, move over to West Seattle and start an electric bike company, because that is going to be the fastest and easiest way to get to Seattle proper if you need to go there. I suspect a lot of people in West Seattle are going to sell and move, mm-hmm. Or are going to try and relocate work south of West Seattle, which is just as easy or hard as it ever was, or find their way back into Seattle proper if they want to avoid what will be, once the work restrictions stop, the worst commute in Washington State.
Yeah, we already have 4 mile backups, and traffic on East Marginal, West Marginal, has doubled. There's 26,000 people there. So.
With 30% of the work of drivers out on the road.
Exactly.
It's going to be a rolling, or actually an idling nightmare.
Well said. More Cairo Nights, everybody, coming up next. Stay tuned.